Thank you, Karen. And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening. Please give a warm welcome to Mike from Sparks, Nevada. Is that what you said?
No, that's not correct.
Okay, Doug. Excuse me. And now... He doesn't get confused every now and then. And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening. Please give a warm welcome to Doug B. from San Diego.
Thanks. Man, I'm miles away from this microphone. I know. I'm going to get closer to it. A quick word from our stagehand.
Can you excuse us for 1 second? We want to make an announcement.
Yeah. And now, an important announcement.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have the air conditioning on, and I see a lot of people that are kind of antsy about the air conditioning not being able to catch up with the heat outside coming in. We open the doors. It's up to you. If you want to turn the air conditioner off and we'll open the doors up, that's fine with me. I just like to see you be comfortable.
See, do I want air? Or I want heat. My name's Doug, alcoholic. Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. I noticed a few people out there that I recognize. Can you hear me all right now?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, my sponsor that I had by the name of Tom Parkinson, the average alcoholic, some of you may have met him, died with 22 years sober. He said that there's three things I should know. What my sobriety date is, that's March 25th of 1995. What my home group is, currently it's the OB Tuesday night meeting. And who my sponsor is, and that's Jim G., who was picked by Tom P. before he died. There's many times I thought of, like, kind of moving on to a more progressive sponsor, you know, like giving Jim G the boot. But I kind of thought, like, you know, that would almost be an insult to Tom P., who I'm sure gave it a lot of thought before he gave me that suggestion. And so I continue to keep that same sponsor. I don't know, where I first got sober, they said you don't change sponsors until the sponsor dies. So I don't know if that works for you, but that's kind of like where I'm going right now, this particular stage. So I want to welcome the newcomers that introduced themselves, and maybe some that didn't. And a happy birthday to the birthday recipients. Karen with a Y. Mike, who I thought was the president of AA when I got here tonight. And Mike Snide, who I've known for his, he's known me for my entire sobriety. OB Mike Snide, yeah. Okay, let's see. I've spoken a few times, and this is the first time I ever actually prepared. So it was a suggestion by Randy, who left a long, rambling phone message about, you know, the proper procedure here at Southern California Speakers. So I thought, you know, why in the hell should I listen to him? I mean, that's what I thought, but what I did was decided to actually, you know, review the big book. So I spent a couple hours, a couple cups of coffee, reviewing this, a few cigarettes. Sorry, folks, I'm still addicted to nicotine and caffeine, the only drugs legally sanctioned by AA, as far as I can tell. And, you know, I kind of, too, I thought it would be a good idea to pray and ask God to guide my words, because The ego tends to take over pretty easily with me. And so I did that, and you know, there's a few prayers that I learned around here. The first prayer that I could actually say without, I don't know, that I didn't have some revulsion towards was the Serenity Prayer, because I came here with a lot of contempt prior to investigation. Out of desperation, I overcame that contempt. So now I have no problem with any prayer. But, you know, in AA we got the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, and the St. Francis prayer. And so I didn't actually say the St. Francis prayer, but I said the third and seventh and a Serenity Prayer numerous times before coming here, and right before I was misintroduced as Mike. But, hey, I got no resentments, man. And then I decided I would, with a Sharpie, I would write in my big book, "Tell the truth, it will set you free." So there are a few people here that know me, have heard my story, so, you know, I tend to like to embellish from time to time. It makes for a better story. So those people being in this room will kind of curtail that to... And since I did say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, you know, to ask God to remove those defects of character, I'm confident that he will remove the defects of character except when my defects would serve you. So you may hear a few defects of mine tonight, and that's okay, because I am a human being. Yeah, let's see. Oh, where did this book come from? Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple guys, you probably know the history of AA, Bill and Bob. And one thing that was like really striking to me, first of all, when I got here, I didn't want anything to do with this book. But out of desperation, I finally came to believe that it might be a good idea to start reading it because it was supposedly about the disease of alcoholism. But the one striking thing about the meeting of Bill and Bob to me was Clancy usually tells it in his story, and he can tell it better than I can, but it's basically when Bill's at that hotel in Ohio, and, you know, alcoholism is doing its mystic magic, man, with the clinkling of the ice, you know, the pouring of the certain liquids over the ice, you know, that just sort of vibe that goes around in probably some beautiful women in high heels and skirts, you know. And that Bill went to that phone booth and made 10 phone calls before he actually talked to somebody. That's how Clancy tells it. I don't know if that's fact, but that's the way he tells it. Before he actually talked to somebody, it didn't hang up on him. And he was in there, he was on an alcoholic alone. So you hear a lot around here, and they talked about a phone commitment for this group. And that's how important that phone is, man. Because no matter how many computers you have in your house or how many cell phones you own, if you don't use them to call another alcoholic, you know, it's a useless tool. So, and one of my relapses was under those circumstances of me being too contemptuous to use that phone. But let's start at the beginning. I was born in a shack. My mama died, and my daddy got drunk. It's a great song, but I wasn't born in a shack. I'm the oldest of six, the Irish-American, Catholic, probably a lot of alcoholics in my family tree on both sides. First 5 years, as far as I recall, were great. Apparently, at my fifth birthday party, I was being somewhat of a brat, and my father might have had a little bit of whiskey going on, and he slapped me across the face. I've since gotten over that resentment. I have written about it. I have got outside issues as well as sponsors and processed that thoroughly. What I know now is that he was an alcoholic. And I forgive him for that and any other actions, most of which were really not, he wasn't violent, he didn't beat us, he didn't, you know, berate us, et cetera, et cetera. He did the best he could with what he had. And, you know, he worked. You know, he was successful in his early years as an alcoholic, like a lot of us are. And then eventually alcoholism brought him down to where he worked lesser and lesser jobs. My mother was a RN, so she was really the primary breadwinner for the family. And but I got slapped at my fifth birthday, and the thought that entered my head was, I am never listening to another word he says. He doesn't know what's fucking happening. You know? And I don't know that I formulated those words, but that was kind of the intent in my brain at that particular time. So, from the five years of age onward, I did what I wanted, when I wanted, and I didn't care what the consequences were. I would pay the consequences. And so that's kind of like what they talked about when I first came in. They would talk about the alcoholic mind and self-will run riot and all that sort of stuff. I didn't really understand what they were talking about. What's this have to do with drinking, you know? But really, it has everything to do with drinking. But if you're new, don't ponder that particular situation. And you may not have had the kind of self-will that I had. But and it talks about in the book a lot about that. You know, like self, you know, our willpower would only carry us so far. And you know, I went on my merry way. I was playing hooky from kindergarten. I learned how to do that. That was a habit that persisted for the rest of my formal early education. So as a result of that, I wasn't able to get into the high school that I had to take an exam for, the Catholic high school that all my friends did. So, you know, I was in a trade school, and I'm, Jesus, man, what, you know, what's a trade? I don't know anything about this trade. I don't think I really want to do this. So I attended very few sessions at that particular school. And then my grandfather, who saw that I was probably, like, you know, going to become some sort of a fatality of one kind or another, hooked me up with a job. And it was a fucking great job, man. It was working in a TV station. And back in the day, before cell phones, emails, et cetera, they had these guys called messengers. So I was a messenger that went from the Baltimore Sun, the newspaper, to WMAR-TV, the TV station. It was owned by the same corporation at the time. And actually, I was based at the TV station. So I would go to the newspaper twice a day, and they would give me what they called car fare, you know, to take a bus over there. I figured I can walk faster than I can get there by bus. I'll just pocket the money. I mean, hey, what's the problem with that, man? And, you know, and I met guys at the TV station that on a Friday afternoon, they would have a few beers down in the prop room. So I, you know, I just saw, like, everything about drinking was great. You know, I mean, the feeling, I drink because I love the effect. I mean, that's the main reason I drink alcohol, is for the effect. And everybody I ever admired, whether they were a writer or a musician, a sports person, whoever they were, they always seemed to either were alcoholic or had a predisposition to consume large quantities of alcohol on our regular occasions. And so that was kind of like, you know, where I went with it. Drank, you know, regularly since puberty. So anything I know about sex is all mixed in with alcohol. So it kind of gives you a distorted perspective, really, on what sexuality is really all about. And, of course, I didn't know that, you know. I mean, I grew up with slogans that I embraced are better living through chemistry. You're never alone with a cigarette and a drink. I can will myself to power. You know, and it seemed like a good way to get ahead in the world, you know, to do that kind of stuff. And I always had a job. I was self-supporting from the time I was 16, like I said, you know. Got married young, was all, you know, I used to travel around with racehorses. I wanted to be a racehorse trainer. So I worked for some, you know, the best people in the country at that particular time in the early 60s. And they were the kind of people that carried a fifth of J&B Scotch in the trunk, you know. And Eddie Neloy, he was the most successful trainer at Aqueduct at that particular time. And he had about 60, 70 head of horses that were all owned by other people. He was too smart to use his own money to buy racehorses. You buy the racehorses, you pay me, I win the races. And so I would look at people like that, and that, you know, these are accomplished people that know how to move in the world. I'm impressed. So I thought that was the way I would also be moving in the world, is by utilizing the same actions. So I don't know, before I get too far off, you guys are kind of looking like a little mystified, like he's kind of trailing off. Is he losing his train of thought? I have a long history of personal alcoholism. My personal history is 35 years of drinking and using. Primarily, alcohol is my drug of choice. I've used everything out there except for crack, which wasn't invented before I got sober. I have smoked high-grade qualities of numerous substances. I have snorted numerous quantities of high-grade substances, and some not so high-grade. I have smoked kilos of marijuana. I come to you somewhat damaged. My first sponsor, Craig, he says, you got to remember, in Alcoholics Anonymous, these people are great, man, they're a lot of fun, but they are damaged goods. So he said, it's really not a good idea to look for a mate in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I personally know of quite a few, at least half a dozen, that have found their mates in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they seem to be having as good a marriage as anybody else out there. I mean, after all, the odds are 50-50, your marriage is going to end in divorce, whether you're an alcoholic or you're a normie. Whatever a normie is, I don't know how to distinguish normies. But I know how to distinguish an alcoholic to some degree. So in order to keep my sobriety, they said I got to give it away, you know. And what that means is my primary purpose upon awakening is to put my sobriety first and carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And a lot of times that alcoholic does not want to do anything about their drinking, but they would like to take care of all these other things. And that is my experience when I came to AA. And I was at the, what was that beep? Is that my 10-minute signal? So I don't know. I drank and used as long as I possibly could. It worked for a long time. I had a lot of fun, a lot of great times. A lot of you, you know, probably did the same, otherwise you wouldn't have continued to drink. And I drove drunk. Oh, who knows? You know. Probably thousands and thousands of times, and was never pulled over. If I was pulled over, it was so early in my drinking that back in those days, they said, okay, we'll just take it easy on the way, you know, the rest of the way home or something, you know. And then it seemed like, I think I mentioned I got married young. I had two kids. I really wasn't ready for the kids. I said, let me get the diploma first. And then we'll, you know, but apparently she didn't listen, the birth control didn't work, whatever it was. I was blessed with two daughters, and, my kids are, you know, great, man. And it's amazing how they've turned out, you know, with a parent like me. And I was a good parent for about the first 7-8 years. And by then, of course, I didn't know this at the time, but my alcoholism was taking over. And it was controlling my thinking. And it was giving me, you know, ideas that I thought were, that's really bizarre, but I would act on it anyway. And so my story includes a lot of infidelity. I was in the Navy. Oh, yeah, I got drafted, you know, they sent out these notices, come see us, whatever. So I ended up in the service, and I didn't want to be there, but I figured I didn't have any choice, and my father was a Purple Heart, a Bronze Star guy in the Army. He wasn't going to tell me, don't go. And I was not a good I ended up in the Navy. I was not a good sailor. So if there's any career sailors in here or people that did serve their full term of their enlistment or their draft assignment, whatever it was, I respect you and honor you. But I was not one of those people. And actually, it all started because this commander of the ship, I got highlined across at sea. And that was that was one of the highlights of my naval adventures. And there was, the captain was greeting people. I think there were three or four of us. They were refueling at sea, and then you got on this little chair, and you, you know, whatever, 15 knots in the open ocean, you know, fly across this thing. It was fucking great. And so the captain, and I guess a couple probably other people, high-ranking people were there, probably the master chief or whatever. And the first thing the guy said, I mean, I'm out in the middle of the ocean. The wind's blowing. It's, over in the Vietnam area. I don't know exactly where because they never tell you exactly where you are. But, you know, I had bangs maybe about this long, and the first thing he said was, there'll be no beetles aboard this ship. And I thought, this is not a good thing, you know. This is not a good omen. I don't know if this is going to work. And then they gave me a job. They told me they were going to send me to shipfitting school after I went over and did my Vietnam thing. And I said, great. I couldn't think of anything else, so I just wrote down shipfitter. That sounded, you know, like, you know, build the ships, you know. Sail on them when you want to, not fucking 6 months at a time. And, you know, it was, I met a lot of good guys in there. You know, they were great. I loved when you pulled into port. You know, that was my most favorite part of being in the Navy. Because here were all these bars and all these women that were just dying to meet you. And, you know, it was great, you know. And I didn't have any trouble on any of my excursions out there in some of these foreign ports. You know, I didn't get arrested. I didn't, you know, whatever. None of that, you know, didn't do anything that was, you know. All I wanted to do was, hey, get a bottle and get a girl, you know, and go listen to some rock and roll. Because those guys were playing some good rock and roll over there. I mean, you know, they were playing the rock and roll as good as the people that wrote it, you know, And so I said, yeah, that's the key, because I always wanted to do that. You know, my grandmother was a graduate of Peabody School of Music in Maryland, a really good pianist. When I was a kid, I used to get her to play. One of my favorites was the theme for Rawhide. You know? And, dim dog, he's rolling, Rawhide, Rawhide. And that was Clint Eastwood in there, man, you know? And, so I'd say, faster, Grandma, faster. And she played faster and faster. And then another one I liked was Peter Gunn. You know, if anybody ever saw that. And that's a famous bass line that's been used through songs from the beginning, from back then in the 50s on up till today, including Jimi Hendrix is probably the most famous exponent of that particular bass line. Just a little music trivia throw in there. And, you know, that's what I always wanted to be, but I didn't seem to be able to get it together well enough to do it. I had a hard time tuning the guitar. It was one kind of a drawback. And so, I mean, these were all the ideas that were in my head. You know, be a racehorse trainer. Be a musician. You know, be this, be that, you know. And it seemed like through alcohol and drugs, you were able to do that, you know. Like, if you can see it, you can be it. And surfing, you know, and so whatever my fantasies were, I just went for them, you know. And I thought, well, I hated early school, but college is a different story. I'll do great in college because they're not telling you what to wear, you know, those uniforms we had to wear in the Catholic schools, little maroon ties, little white shirts. Once a nun sent me home for a haircut, I took the money, went downtown, went to the movies. I didn't care what the consequences were. I just did it, man. And so, you know, I had all these ideas in my head, and I met this woman when I got back to San Diego from the military, and, you know, that was the beginning sort of a little bit of trouble because I had a date, and then I had paid somebody to stay on my duty, and that was a common practice back in those days, at least the people I knew. And this guy that was the head cook or whatever, he says, "You're not, you know, you got mess duty. You're not going." I said, "Well, so and so's here. He's doing it. You know, there he is, right here. He's ready to serve." And he told me I couldn't go, and I said, "Fuck him." You know, I got a date, man. I'm going. And so I got back. I was 17 hours AWOL, and they gave me a real short haircut and put me in. Gave me 3 days bread and water. You know, this will teach him. Now he'll listen. Well, for a person like me, that doesn't work. For some people, it does. And so, like in AA, the drill sergeant approach to sponsorship does not work for me. I have to see what you have, and if I like what you have, not you, Larry. you know, and that, so that's, I'm kind of jumping around here, and I hope you can kind of follow it. But, I mean, my whole purpose up here tonight is to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety, you know. If you're mildly entertained, great. Let's get back to the book. Yeah. What they told me in AA when I got here was, you know, if I forgot what it was like out there and then went on to live my life, that I would return to drinking again. And Karen kind of talked about that. So basically, it's a principle in history. You know, those that forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And we can see that with a lot of our political leaders. But that's an outside issue. So I finally came to that realization. That was one of my spiritual awakenings in Alcoholics Anonymous, all of which have been of the educational variety. I have not had any burning bushes or whatever. I thought I was having a conversation with my friend David from Harmony Group. He's sitting in the back one time about spiritual awakenings or whatever, and he said, "Well, most of the burning bushes are down on the beach." And I had to agree, most of the burning bushes are down there on the beach. So I guess that's politically incorrect because I didn't get the laugh I thought I was going to get there. But, you know, I was out there, I was a rock and roll maniac, man. You know, in 1976, I had this awakening. This was before AA. Had this awakening. Okay, what you got to do, because the kind of music you're trying to do is not going to work in San Diego. First, you got to go to New York. You make it happen in New York. You know what Frank Sinatra said. Make it happen in New York. Then you go to Europe. Then, when you come back, America will love you. That's what Jimmy did. So I tried that, but I only got as far as New York. And, you know, I left my family, you know. I deserted my family. I got loaded up a rental car with an amplifier, a kilo of pot, which was going to sustain me over that period of for income for the next 6 months, and went to New York, and it was a horrible disaster, you know. Got some success with a band there, but it all fell apart. And so that's what I started to unravel, basically. You know, so that's what alcoholism is kind of like. You're like going along, you're making all this progress, but of course you're drinking along the way. And so for me, what would happen is I'd be going along in this great trajectory. Then all of a sudden, bam, here's the fucking highway patrol. So like I said, I drove thousands of times, never had a DUI. All of a sudden, it seemed like I had three or four of them, like right in a row. And, you know, and I said, screw this, I'm not driving. And I know people have said that before in meetings, I've heard them say it. And just so you know, I've been a lot of meetings, I've heard a lot of people share, and I listen. I try and listen and focus on what they're sharing. Not that you have to do that for me. But that's what I do to try and stay sober. And so most of the stuff I'm saying up here tonight, with the exception of my personal, you know, anecdotes, are all stuff I've heard in AA, read in the book, somebody's paraphrased, whatever, I'm paraphrasing it. It's nothing really new under the sun. But, you know, if we knew, you know, that old thing when you get older, if I knew then what I knew now. And alcoholics don't work like that, at least I don't, you know. Because if we just listened to the stop, so saw the stop sign and just stopped for it and said, hey, my life's starting to go out, you know, spiraling out of control, and just stopped, we wouldn't need AA. You know, we wouldn't need each other. But I need you, man. You know, I need AA. AA can get along fine without me, but I can't get along without AA. So that's, you know, really, if you don't agree with anything else, hopefully you agree with that. So I was on my way somewhere, probably had something to do with alcohol or drugs, and this car I was driving broke down. And let me say, too, I manipulated women big time when I was out there. I have an expensive guitar, and that guitar spent more time in the pawn shop than it spent on my hands as my disease took over. And I would get women to get my guitar out. I got to get back on track. I got to write some songs, blah, blah, blah. Pretty soon, I'm out of money. Back to the pawn shop. So if you ever need a good pawn shop, there's one downtown on 4th. They're an honest pawn shop. They're not going to go out of business if you need to hawk some. I'm not going to tell you the name because that's an outside issue. But, you know, so that's how I ended up starting to live. You know, I mean, I had a job from the time I was 11 years old, and all of a sudden my job was making music, but it wasn't paying. You know, so you know how it is with artists. You need benefactors. You know, you need, you know, help you out, you know. You know, and so when I deserted my family and I went to, you know, that was horrible, man. Oh, that was horrible. And I came back and realized I did the wrong thing. I tried to get back together, but of course, active alcoholism and reunification with family doesn't really work that well. Went back into my rock and roll derelict. I mean, basically, sex and drugs and rock and roll. It's all my body needs. And that's, you know, that's how I was living, and I was fine with that. You know, just make a fucking mark, man, on the world, you know. Make a mark, have an impact, you know, and it didn't work. So the benefactors slowly fell to the side. I had less and less couches to surf on. So, I hate to say it, but actually, I became homeless. And, you know, I was a regular donor, actually a valued donor at the Plasma Center, where I would go as many times as I could go in a month and sell my blood. And then, you know, nothing says hello like giving a pint of blood and then going right to the liquor store and getting a half pint of vodka and drinking it straight down. That is a massive effect of alcohol. And I loved it, man. You know, that is pretty demented. You know, that is very demented. So, okay. All right, you've been at a Plasma Center. Well, what I finally found out was, you know, I didn't know how to stop drinking. I wanted to stop drinking. I didn't know how. You know, I hate what the thing is. If you drink a liter of vodka a day, bare minimum, which is my... You know, what I would add at the end. I prefer 20-year-old scotch, but I end up with plain wrap vodka. You may as well buy in half gallons because that fucking liter is not going to last. You know, and it's just, I remember once I had three drinks at the same time in front of me. You know, a screwdriver, whiskey in the coffee, and a Dos Equis beer. Now, that's the breakfast of champions. Of course, I had, you know, I had eggs, tortillas, you know, I had the full breakfast. So, I mean, hey, what's wrong with that? It's a weekend. You know, that's how I, you know, what I got to, man. And it was just like, oh, I'd get so sick. I couldn't, you know, some of you guys might identify, maybe not. But I encountered this place called the Vietnam Veterans, and they said, why don't we put you in a hospital? And I thought that sounded good because I was damn near dead. You know, I was living on hot popcorn, which I had taken from the movie theater that I used to get free passes to, discreetly, of course, after they closed, and vodka for 3 days. I was really sick, and they put me in the VA. Well, the mind and body regenerate really quickly. You know, for me at that time, it was about 2 weeks, and you're feeling great. You're eating regular, you're sleeping, you know, doing a little exercising. All right, you know, and now you can go out home for the weekend. Fantastic. Well, I didn't have a home. Where am I going to go? Back to the old friends. What are they going to say? Would you like something to drink? And that was in 82, and I didn't really understand what people were talking about. I remember some guys brought a meeting in there one night, and all I heard the guy say was, no sex for the first year. This guy obviously doesn't understand where I'm coming from. You know, that is ridiculous. And so that's what, I'm sure he didn't say that, but that's what I heard him say. So it really is a disease of perception like they talk about. So I had a few more things happen. You know, I broke my back. I had a torso cast on for 6 months. I had cocktail parties in the hospital for 10 days in there. Are they going to operate? They're going to put the torso cast on, blah, blah, blah. Got out of there, and that was another part where my alcoholism really took off because I was in pain continually. I mean, I was always in pain mentally, but now I was in pain physically too. So, you know, it was insane. And, you know, I just went on like it was just a little bump in the road, man. Never thought about stopping drinking. You know, alcohol couldn't possibly have anything to do with me being homeless, wearing a torso cast, living off of women and other assorted friends. By 1886, I got invited to a wedding. It was my sister. It was in Rhode Island. I was living in a place, a hotel, where they pay their rent by the day. I had an enabler that would go to work. Then she would come over, pay the rent for the day, give me a liter of vodka and a bag of Mexican food. And I was ashamed to go out. You know, I would not go out until it was, say, like 11, midnight. And maybe I'd walk around. It was over in Hillcrest. They call it the Friendship Hotel now. I don't know what they call it then. But, you know, and the best I could do in under those circumstances, a guy alone in a room with a flickering TV, somewhere between 2 and 5 a.m., I would achieve nirvana. And then I would wake up, and it would be another 18 hours working all day at drinking to get back there again. So I drank and used as long as I possibly could. Let's fit. I know they're looking at their watches. When is he going to get sober? So I went to another treatment center. I was doing a scholarship, you know. My sister, they got married. She knew some people, and they got me in there. It was kind of like a McDonald's center type thing. I thought it was fucking great, man. You know, they treated you really good. They fed you really good. They gave me all this education about the physical, the psychological effects of alcoholism and drug addiction on the human body. And then they also brought guys in to do meetings, you know. And I thought I had it. And took a job I was not supposed to take as a counselor for kids in a group home. They said, do not take that job. You won't be able to handle it. I said, you don't know me. I'll do it. 3 months later, I was drinking again. Back to the treatment center again, almost a year to the day. So basically, from what I tried to do in AA is do as little as possible. Like she talked about earlier, Karen with the Y, I was like on the outside. I didn't want to hold your hand. I didn't want to say any prayers. I didn't want to do steps, all that sort of stuff. And finally, just out of desperation, I started doing it. I asked this guy named Tom P., the average alcoholic, to be my sponsor. And I already told you what the three things he said, what my home group was. At the time, it was Harmony Group in Ocean Beach, 6 days a week at 6:45. I'm not a morning person. It doesn't matter. Just go. And I did. And I know a lot of people from when I first came in that are still going to that meeting. And so I wanted to thank Harmony Group, you know, as part of my sobriety. I wanted to thank the Common Bond Group in Rhode Island. I want to thank the Point Loma Men's. And so I'm a member of the Point Loma Men's. That's a regular group. The OB Tuesday night meeting is a regular meeting. And I had other meetings sporadically, such as this one. Well, I want to make sure I didn't forget anybody. I want to thank Craig, my first sponsor. I want to thank Charlie and Ian, who were three Californians that came to New England and identified with them, and they became my support system. Roy from the Point Loma Men's, who was my first sponsor when I moved back to San Diego in 91. Homer from Point Loma Men's, who one time said, is AA better now, or was it better back in the day? Homer's opinion was that AA was actually better now because we know more about the disease. And I think he had like 40 years of sobriety or something like that when he passed away. I want to thank Larry and Leslie. At 3 years of sobriety, I encountered a significant other addiction, and I went to Al-Anon for 4 years, actually took a four-year chip in Al-Anon. So that is a sister program, for those of you who have never heard of it. And a sponsor suggested to me, if you work with a lot of people, which I don't work with a whole lot of people, I have a few sponsees, one of whom is here tonight. Hi, Chris. You know, that I should understand more about the disease. And really, I was going insane with the addiction of another person. So I hope none of you ever have to face that in your sobriety. But if you do, I highly recommend Al-Anon. I want to thank Joel, who's also from the Harmony Group, and David, Boston Bob, who shows up at this meeting frequently, Crazy Jack, who was one of the founders of Harmony Group in Ocean Beach. He's got 33 years. O.B. Ernie, who told me, you know what, kid, I don't think you're going to make it. I said, fuck you, Ernie. When I had a couple years of sobriety, Ernie asked if I would help him hire some guys to move him to Arizona. So I helped Ernie with that, and I heard he went to the big meeting in the sky. So I wanted to thank him. How are we doing on time? Bell ringer, what time? I'm done? Okay. Well, I want to thank all of you for participating in my sobriety and your own by being here tonight. I didn't get to go through all the quotes I had done, but that's okay. That bell's ringing again, I guess I mean. Okay, I should sum it up. You know, so basically, my primary focus is to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. So, you know, Tom said in order to keep my sobriety, I had to give it away. That means being active with the group, not just going there, but doing something with the group, some sort of a commitment. So I have had commitments numerous times through my sobriety. And get active with the sponsor, which means doing the steps. I didn't talk a lot about the steps, but without the steps, I would not be here. And so, sorry to say, if you haven't done the steps and you don't want to do them, I don't know. Ask your sponsor what he thinks. And really, today, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, man, all my problems are problems of abundance. You know, I've been gainfully employed, you know, for almost my whole sobriety. You know, they trust me with the keys to the office, the building, the clicker to open up the garage. I mean, don't they know, you know, this is the guy who used to sell blood to get the next bottle of vodka, you know. So, hey, everybody, keep coming back. It's been a pleasure. Good night.